Let's read again in the book of Psalms, the psalm we read, Psalm number 17 and verse 15. As for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness. Total satisfaction guaranteed. I'm sure you've heard that phrase before. You've probably read it. You've maybe said it. It's a phrase that's often attached to advertisements and commercials, trying to get us to buy various cars, appliances, vacations, and try other experiences like eating and other entertainments. Total satisfaction guaranteed. There's something, of course, incredibly appealing about that claim, that assertion, because it's saying, you do this, you get this, you be this, and everything will be perfect. Everything will be just so. It will be, you will feel complete. Everything will be just right. Total satisfaction guaranteed. Well, many of us have believed such a claim and been disappointed, of course, haven't we? We've bought it, we've tried it, we've been there, we've done it, and the promise has not been fulfilled, and it leaves us feeling rather hollow and disappointed. Maybe something similar can happen in the Christian faith. Maybe some of you who are believers here became believers with the hope or even the promise or expectation that becoming a Christian would result in total satisfaction guaranteed. That is promised in some churches, some presentations of the gospel, or we should say some so-called presentations of the gospel. But even in sound Orthodox churches, we can still have that expectation that when I become a Christian, everything's just going to be just right. All my problems are going to fade away. Everything's going to be just so. Everything's going to be fixed. Total satisfaction guaranteed. And then reality bites. That's what's happening in this psalm. The psalmist is experiencing suffering and persecution, which is made all the worse because when this believer, David, looks at unbelievers, he sees them succeeding and prospering. And this clash of expectations has some pretty devastating consequences. If we have come into the Christian faith or we've had some expectation that everything's going to work out just perfectly and swimmingly and then everything goes pear-shaped, then it's going to affect us. It's going to result in a loss of hope. We will become very focused on the present. We will only see what is real today, where we look at our own situations and it's hard, we look at the unbelievers and it's so good, and the only day we see in the calendar is today. And that gets us down and discouraged. We lose our hope, we lose our focus as well. All we see is the unbeliever's success. You scroll through Instagram and you see all the celebrities living all their ungodly lives, and yet all the things they have, all the experiences they have. You see the Kardashians, or you go to YouTube stars and you see Jake Paul and PewDiePie and all the wealth and possessions, and then you look at your life, and what a contrast. You're focused on them, and it gets you down. And as you lose your hope and as you lose your focus, you're going to lose your joy. You're going to become bitter, depressed, discouraged, envious, and you're going to lose your witness as well. Because people will look at you as you lose your hope, you lose your focus, and you lose your joy, and they're going to say, well, you're no different to anyone else. I don't see anything desirable about your faith, about your witness. So you see, there are huge consequences that flow from this problem, this clash, this sense of disappointed expectations. So what can we do about it? Because we're going to face it at some point or other in our lives. Maybe not early in our Christian lives, but eventually in our Christian lives. We're going to go through something like this. We're going to be persecuted, or we're going to suffer, and we're going to see the ungodly and the unbeliever succeeding and prospering, and joy and hope and focus and our witness is going to start evaporating. How do we stop that? How do we fix that? How do we reverse that? That's what the psalmist brings before us here. And what he tells us is we can face suffering with hope if we keep our focus on the satisfying joy at the end of life. We can keep our hope if we keep our focus on the satisfying joy at the end of the Christian life. Just to briefly look at this psalm as a whole before we focus in on verse 15. The first four verses are a prayer for justice. He's been suffering false accusation and he prays for justice. Then verses 5 to 6, he prays for grace in the midst of this trial to keep living through this. Then in verse 7 through 12, he's praying for protection from his persecutors. And then verses 13 to 15, he's comforting himself with contrasting ends. The end of the wicked and the end of the believer. And that's what we want to see this evening, because these verses bring before us two truths, two insights. And the first is this: the satisfaction of the unbeliever is limited. The satisfaction of the unbeliever is limited. It's limited as to their objects of satisfaction, as to the time of satisfaction, and as to the experience of satisfaction. Now, sometimes we might say as preachers, or we might say to others in our witness, you know, the unbeliever has no satisfaction. That's not actually true. The unbeliever can have some satisfaction in some things for some time. That's just the facts. There's no point in denying reality. Some of us remember it when we were unbelievers. Some of you are unbelievers here tonight. And you can see that's true. That is perfectly true. I get some satisfaction in some things for some time. And that's what the psalmist here sees as well in verse 14. As he looks at the unbeliever, how does he describe them? He describes them as filled, as full, as satisfied, as even overflowing. They're full of power. Notice that phrase. They are men of the world. This is their place. This is their time of influence. This is their sphere of enjoyment. They are men of the world. They are full of worldly power. As the earlier part of this psalm shows, they can really do whatever they want. They are also full of stuff. They've got all the possessions they could want. We read, they have their portion in this life. They have a lot in this life. We also read, they are filled with sensual satisfaction. And it's described here, whose belly you fill with your hid treasure. And it's really speaking of food and drink and the things that can satisfy the bodily senses. Food and drink being just an illustration of many things that can satisfy our eyes, our ears, our taste, our touch, our smell. Full of sensual satisfaction. They're full of children. Here we read, they are full of children. And then we read they have a full inheritance. They leave the rest or the abundance or the overflow of their substance to their babes. Do you see? The psalmist is very truthful, very realistic. He looks out on this world and he sees the unbelievers and the wicked and he says, they have satisfaction. It's limited, but it's satisfaction. It's some of them who have it, and they have it in some things, and they have it for some time. That's just the facts of the matter. If you're an unbeliever, you can have satisfaction. You can have a sense of being filled up, even to overflowing in many aspects of life. But remember, the truth, the unbeliever has limited satisfaction. Satisfaction indeed, but limited. Limited in its objects, it's limited to a certain range of things. Limited in experience, doesn't rise to the highest satisfactions, as we'll see. And above all, it's limited in time. It doesn't go on forever. It's temporary. It has a time limit on it. And that's what the psalmist says here. They leave the rest of their substance to babes. He's viewing them as departing this world. He's seeing them as having had some satisfaction in some things for some time, but now it's over. And they are leaving, they are departing. And all that they found satisfying and filling and enjoyable is in the rearview mirror. It's over. It's finished. The end. It's over. We're going to see in verse 15 how the unbeliever opens his or her eyes in heaven. But the unbeliever also will open his or her eyes, but in hell. Remember the story that Jesus told about the rich man and Lazarus, how the rich man also died and was buried. And in hell, he lift up his eyes, being in torment. That's all he sees now. No more comforts, no more pleasures, no more satisfaction. It's now torment, it's torture, it's emptiness, it's thirst, it's hunger. Satisfaction is over, filling is over, pleasure is over. It's limited. And even if they lived 70, 80, 90, or 100 years, it's so short compared to what is now ahead. They have nothing. They have nothing. And if it's you, friend, you will have nothing. Nothing. However much you had, however much satisfaction you had in this world, now there's nothing left. Nothing. This is a classic case, isn't it, of penny wise and dollar foolish. People who were extremely careful about the smallest things, the pennies, but completely oblivious to the big things, the dollars. Penny wise, dollar foolish. They were totally occupied with the present and completely forgot about the future, about eternity. This is put in God's word as a warning to us. No matter how much satisfaction or how long your satisfaction lasts or how many things you find satisfaction in, no matter how much you are filled, it's limited. It's temporary. It's very soon going to be over and finished. The satisfaction of the unbeliever is, present tense, limited. But the second truth here, the second insight we're given is this, that the satisfaction of the believer will be, future tense, will be total. The satisfaction of the believer will be total. Now, I've said future tense there because that's what is going to be brought before us in verse 15. That's not to say the Christian doesn't have satisfaction in this world at times, not at all. In fact, in some ways, the Christian finds more satisfaction than the unbeliever. We can find satisfaction in the smallest thing, in a cup of cold water, in the most basic meal, because we see it as the gift of our Heavenly Father. We don't need to have plenty. We don't need to have luxury to have a sense of real joy and filling when we trace everything to God. So there are times, there are moments, there are seasons when we do feel tremendous satisfaction here in this world. But for most believers, a large part of their Christian life is going to be a suffering life, a painful life. It may be very personal. So the suffering may be just things like bodily illnesses or mental illnesses. It may be personal persecution. It might be that in our family or in our community or in our workplace or in our nation that we are very personally and individually targeted for persecution, that people will want us to lose and suffer just because we are Christians, and that seems to be what was happening to David. But even if we don't suffer so individually and personally, that kind of very targeted persecution, every Christian feels persecuted to some degree or another by our culture. I think we often miss that. We often think of persecution as, you know, somebody with a gun to our heads saying, renounce Christ, or in a prison, or being tortured, or things. And that's for sure terrible persecution, but there's a more subtle form that every Christian is subject to, especially in our culture, even just the daily sights we have to see and the sounds we have to hear. When we see the way that our culture is going with our media, with our celebrities, with even the kinds of agendas that are pursued successfully by many politicians, the liberalizing of our laws, the disintegration of morality, the perverting of morality, the turning upside down, the calling of good evil and evil good. This is an agony to the believer. It's a terrible pain. It's an oppression. It grieves, it pains, it goes to our very core. And so that's the norm for a Christian in this world. It's the norm to suffer. Individually or generally and culturally, we feel targeted. We feel people say things, do things, pursue things, pass laws just to get at Christians. It's not that they really want these laws. It's just they want Christians to suffer. They want Christians to feel alienated and isolated. That's why we can identify with this psalm. And so this psalmist here is looking at his sufferings and he's contrasting it with the success and the prosperity of the unbeliever. But what does he say? Here's the first thing he says. As for me. He's painting a contrast. He's had a look. He's looked at the unbeliever's life and he's seen and listed all the things that they have and enjoy and are filled with and satisfied with. And he looks at them and he studies them and he ponders them and he weighs them and he says, no thanks. No thank you. He looks at all that they have and all that they've accumulated and all that they've experienced and he says, you can keep your feathers. I've got a mountain of gold. As for me, there's a determination here. He's saying, I wouldn't exchange my life for yours for all the money in the world. I wouldn't do it for a second. If you came and offered me $100 billion to be an unbeliever for a second, I wouldn't contemplate it. I wouldn't give it a second thought. You can keep your feathers. When we've got ingots of gold. As for me, this is how the believer begins to battle back against this great temptation to envy the wicked and feel sorry for themselves and lose hope, lose focus, lose joy, and lose their witness. They steel themselves, they resolve themselves, they turn away from all that this world offers and they say, no way, no thanks, I'm not going there. And then the next battle is to get his perspective future. Remember, the believer's satisfaction will be, future tense, total. That's where he goes. As for me, I will behold your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake with your likeness. And he brings four elements before us of his total future satisfaction. Here's the first one. He says, I will be satisfied, first of all, because I will awake. I will awake. I shall be satisfied when I awake. Now, what moment is this referring to? Some commentators think this is referring to resurrection, when the believer's body will be brought back together with their soul, but I don't believe that's what this is speaking about. I believe this is speaking about the believer's death. When they fall asleep, as from the perspective of this world, but from the perspective of heaven, they wake up. And indeed, the language here of awakening is really basically saying this. This whole world's been asleep. It's really saying, I've not just transitioned from earth to heaven, I've been transformed from unconsciousness to consciousness. He's really saying, I was alert and I was conscious in this world and I was thinking and I was rational and I was sensitive and I felt things and thought things and did things, but compared to the first moment of eternity, it's like I've never been awake at all. It's like when I get there, it's like I've suddenly come alive. I've awoken from a dream. It's like I've been wandering around in a dizzy, dozy dwam, and now everything is so real and it's so clear and it's so vivid and it's so, I'm just so alert and I'm so awake. There's a new dimension of consciousness here, a new dimension of human experience that makes all of this world look like a deep sleep. I will awake. And in fact, you know how this could be literally translated? It's this. I shall be satisfied in the awaking of your face. That's a beautiful picture. I don't know if you, maybe the moms here can identify with this better, but you know, you might hear your little baby crying and coming to after a sleep, and so you go in and you lean down and you bring your face near the baby's face and you just see the baby coming out of unconsciousness or sleepiness, and the eyes begin to open slightly, and then the eyes go wide open, and they look up, and they see their mom, and there's just this big smile on their face. It's like they've been awakened by this face. And that's what's envisaged here. It's like we've been going through this world just almost half dead, half asleep. And when we get to glory, it's like our eyes open, and what do we see? That will bring you alive. That'll wake you up. That will give you a whole new level of awareness. I will awake. That's his first layer one of satisfaction. Then he says, I will see Christ. He says, I will behold your face in righteousness. I will see your face. So he's been looking at unbelievers' faces. And he's going down. Then he says, I will see his face. Up goes my faith, my hope, my joy, my love. I will see your face. What a face that will be. The real human face of Jesus Christ. That's going to be the friendliest face we have ever seen in our lives. It's going to be the holiest face we've ever seen in our lives. It's going to be the happiest face we've ever seen in our lives. It's going to be a very familiar face. We've lived by faith. We've seen through a glass darkly. then face to face. This is not a stranger. We're not going to wake up if we're believers and say, who's that? It's instant recognition. I know who this is. I know who this is. This is going to be the most beautiful face that we've ever seen and that we ever will see. I will see your face. We close our eyes in this world, and if we die amongst our loved ones, it's a wonderful, blessed experience that, to have loved ones near us. I remember when I was pastoring in Scotland, a lovely Christian friend of mine, a young woman, told me how she helped her dad to die. And he'd been ill for a long time. He was going down. And in his last hour or two, she just climbed into his bed and just lay beside him until he breathed his last. So something really beautiful about that, isn't it? I'm sure that must have been incredibly comforting for that dying Christian man to have his nearest and dearest so close, feeling that warmth. But I think it would be forgotten in a second when he awakes and he sees another face, the face of Jesus Christ. This is why he can say, I will be satisfied. I will be satisfied when I awake. I will be satisfied when I see his face. But thirdly, he says, I will be satisfied because I will be vindicated by Christ. This is one of the agonies of the Christian in this life. It was one of the agonies of the psalmist. He was falsely accused. He was misrepresented. You see that in verse 1. Hear the right, O Lord. Attend to my cry. Give ear to my prayer. Three times he says, I'm crying, I'm crying, I'm crying. He says, let my sentence come forth from your presence. Let your eyes behold the things that are equal. He's saying, Lord, you know what's true. You know I'm not guilty of these things they accuse me of. And he says, you've proved my heart. You've visited me in the night. And he's saying here, concerning these allegations, he's not saying he's perfect, but concerning these specific allegations and misrepresentations, he's saying, Lord, you have come to me when I've been lying in bed, agonizing over these things, and you've cleared my conscience. You have assured me that I am not condemned, that I am justified, that I am innocent, that I am clear of these charges. You've tried me. You've found nothing. And I'm purposed that my mouth shall not transgress. So you can sense here the agony of this. He's got private vindication. He's got vindication in his own conscience, but not in the public arena. In the public arena, he's still slandered. His name is still blackened. He's still being spoken of derogatorily. He's still being misrepresented. And that, again, is why he looks ahead, because he says here, I will behold your face in righteousness. And that is really saying in vindication. You will vindicate me. You will declare me righteous, not just in the court of my own conscience, but in the whole public arena. You will make crystal clear to everyone where the truth lies. And is that not, again, just such a longing for the Christian? There's no Christian in the world that's never suffered misrepresentation. We all have, especially ministers of the gospel. And you'd love to chase down all these lies. You'd love to put out all these fires. And you can't do it. It's impossible. You can have a good conscience. You can have God come to you privately and say, you are in the clear. But we long for more, and we'll get it. In righteousness means in total vindication, that God is going to stand up and he's going to look at that believer and say, she is mine, she is in the clear, she is totally innocent, clear her of all charges. He owns her. He's not ashamed of her. He silences all the lies. He defeats all the misrepresentations. That too is a tremendous source of satisfaction. I will be vindicated by Christ. And then lastly here, I will be satisfied because I will be like Christ. I'll be awakened by Christ, I will see Christ, I'll be vindicated by Christ, I will be like Christ. And this is the climax of it all. I shall be satisfied when I awake with your likeness. When we see him, we shall be like him. When we see him, we shall be like him. Can you believe that? Yes, at the resurrection, we will have bodily perfection like him. That'll be amazing. To be reconstructed. To have this body that's just falling apart and bits falling off it here and there, to have it totally perfected in all its systems, in all its parts, in all its senses. That's going to be amazing, to be transformed and to be made like unto his glorious body. But what's particularly in view here, I believe, is this spiritual likeness. To be like Christ spiritually. What does that mean? It means two things. It means no more sin. And perfect holiness. It means no more envying, no more lusting, no more unbelieving, no more fighting dark thoughts, horrible thoughts, sinful thoughts. That battle is over. As much as Christ has total peace in that area, so will the believer have. Think how satisfying that will be. Flawless forever. No more fighting. No more battling. No more striving. It's not just that we'll be holy after, like, just oodles of effort. No, it's going to be effortless flawlessness. And the positive is perfect holiness, the ability to love all of God's people perfectly, to have no ill will or malice towards anyone, to be able to love God perfectly all the time with no ups and downs. I will be satisfied when I awake with this likeness. And maybe even we can go a wee bit deeper. We'll be satisfied by having our whole personalities reconstructed. No. You know, as you get older, you realize we're all weird. We're all weird. We're all strange creatures. We're just unusual, all of us. We all have twists. We've all got cracks. We're not comfortable. We know we're not right. We're just not the personalities we're meant to be. We've all, you might say, got a personality disorder. And it's just some of us realize it more than others. But perfect personalities, perfect wholeness, everything just right. We'll know exactly who we are. No more weirdness, no more abnormality, no more sense of I'm just not in the right skin here. I just don't know who I am. No, we will have as stable and as sure and as perfect an identity as Christ himself does. He who all through his life on this earth was so sure of who he was, I am this, I am that, I am this, I am that. No questions, verily, verily, so will be of us too. I will be satisfied when I awake with that likeness. and soul. We can say we can face suffering with hope by focusing on the satisfying joy at the end. That's how to rekindle our hope, our focus, our joy, our witness to others. All through this life, it's I will be, I will be, I will be. But then it's I am, I am, I am. I am awake. I am seeing Christ. I am vindicated. I am like Christ. And it's always going to be that way, forever and ever. It's like you bring a thirsty man to the edge of an ocean of the purest water, and you say, this is going to go on and on and on and on and on. It's never going to end. Total satisfaction guaranteed. Total satisfaction guaranteed. That's what is held out to us here in the gospel. When this happens, when we awake in this way, it's going to be the biggest wow we have ever had in our lives. And it's not just the believer who'll be satisfied. God will be satisfied with his work in the believer. So perfect, so beautiful. Let me finish with a story. If you want to look this up on YouTube, it's a video entitled Brutally Honest Valedictorian Regrets Being Top of the Class. It's quite an amazing video. It's a guy called Kyle Martin. He had a 4.6 GPA. He was awarded a $170,000 college scholarship. And the title of his speech was The 16th Second. The 16th Second. And it'll become clear as I read out. This is what he said. He's talking about all the stress and sacrifice he went through to win this. And he says, at the senior awards ceremony, it felt so good when I heard my name announced with this title, valedictorian. It felt so good for about 15 seconds. 15 seconds of my heart racing and my adrenaline pumping. 15 seconds of, yeah, I won. 15 seconds of being at the top with all my accomplishments, and it felt euphoric. But there must come a 16th second. And on that 16th second, I sat down in my seat. I looked at my silver stole that says valedictorian, and I thought, that's it. What just happened? Why am I not feeling anything else? To be honest, I don't even know what I was expecting. A parade of balloons to drop? Or maybe I was hoping that all my problems would fade away in comparison to this amazing achievement, but none of that happened. Not even in my heart. I felt nothing. I was shocked. This was a huge problem for me, and I needed to figure out why. So here was my thought process. Working hard is good. He's a believer, by the way. Is in fact biblical. But it should not be done for the sole purpose of a goal's sake at the expense of relationships with others. Looking back on the year, I see that the goal of a 5-minute speech and a stole around my neck was paid for at the expense of a lack of attending to relationships in my life. What are you striving for? What's your be-all or end-all? I'm glad I only made this mistake for only 1 year. What have I learned this at 50? Or at the end of my life? Have no regret in your 16th second. It's really a modern version of Psalm 17. Limited satisfaction in earthly things. But then the 16th second comes. What then? Eternity comes. What then? Limited satisfaction for a moment, or total satisfaction guaranteed forever. That's it. One or other. You're pursuing one or other. 15 seconds of fame, and then an eternity of nothing. Or an eternity of everything. For the sake of a few years of suffering here below. Surely the choice is obvious. The path is clear. It's a no-brainer. It's really not a choice at all, is it, if we're sane and sensible? Remember, there's a 16th second. There's an eternity. Let's pray.